had big houses, some with white columns, and big lawns, and, for that matter, dogwood. But it just wasn't the same. Nisky Lake didn't have those big green breasts, and the dogwood blossoms didn't seem to exist in such divine clouds. Roger Two-White drove his Lexus up a driveway that ascended the lush swell of the lawn McNutter. As seen through the plains of dogwood blossoms, the house appeared to have been done in the French Maison Lafitte style, with lofty casement windows from which came a soft, mellow light upstairs and down. At the top of the hill, the driveway made a showy loop bordered with liriope in front of the house. Roger Two-White parked near the front door. As he walked toward it, he remembered all the stories he had heard of the black men who had been hassled and detained by not only the police, but also the Buckhead private security patrols, just for being black and setting foot on this hallowed earth near the holy white corridor of West Paces Ferry Road. The doorbell was answered by Coach Buck McNutter himself. Oh, there was no mistake about that. Roger Two-White had never met the man before, but he knew that face. He had seen it God knew how many times on television and in the pages of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It was the real, loose-sausage-eating, brown-liquor-drinking southern face of a white athlete turned 40 and covered with a smooth, well-fed layer of flesh. His neck, which seemed a foot wide, rose up out of a yellow polo shirt and a blue blazer, as if it were unit-welded to his trapezius muscles and his shoulders. He was like a single solid slab of meat clear up to his hair, which was a head of hair and a half, a strange silvery blonde color, coiffed with bouncy fullness and little flips that screamed $65 male hairdo. Not a single cilium was out of place. Amid the vast, smooth meat of his head and neck, his eyes and his mouth seemed terribly tiny. But they were both going all out to register pleasure at the sight of Counselor Roger White, this black man who had arrived at the door at 7:42 on Freaknik Saturday night.
"Hey, Mr. White!" exclaimed Coach Buck McNutter. "Buck McNutter!"
With that, he extended an enormous right hand. Roger Two-White put out his own hand and felt it disappear, knuckles and all, inside a grip that made him wince.
"Sure do appreciate you doing this, particularly on a Saturday night."
"Not at all," said Roger Two-White. There was something so desperate about the man's show of gratitude he didn't bother apologizing for being 12 minutes late.
"Come on in and make yourself comfortable."
Then, over his shoulder,
"Hey, Val, Mr. White's here."
Val turned out to be a blonde woman in her late 20s, if Roger Two-White was any judge. Everything about her, especially the provocative way she lowered her eyebrows when she smiled, gave off whiffs of frisky trouble. She came into the entry hall from some side room with the same desperate delight in her eyes as the coach.
"Hi!"
She really sang it out.
"Mr. White, I want you to meet my wife, Val."
So they shook hands, too. There was so much frenzied grinning going on that Roger Two-White couldn't help grinning himself. He understood part of it. He saw this type of prominent white person all the time in Atlanta. Buck McNutter was a prototypical southern white boy from Mississippi, which was an even harder case than Georgia, a real hardtack cracker in his heart, but one who had decided that if he had to deal with these niggers, then the better part of valor was to put on a good show of being civil about it. Proving Booker T. absolutely right, of course.
"Let's go on in the library, Mr. White," said Buck McNutter.
With this, he dropped the grin. In fact, his beefy face grew long, verging on sad. Obviously, the pertinent part of Counselor White's house call on Habersham Road was about to begin.
"Can I get you something to drink?" said young Mrs. McNutter.
She said it with such an animated grin that for an instant it looked like a leer, and made Roger Two White wonder what on earth she had in mind.
"Oh, no thanks," he said. "You sure? Then I'll just let you two take care of yourselves."
The library was paneled in a dark wood, mahogany or perhaps walnut, and lined with shelves that seemed to contain far more silver bowls, trophies, and pieces of blown glass sculpture than books. The combination of the dark wood, the soft light, and the gleaming objets was such that at first Roger Two White failed to notice the figure sprawled back on a tufted leather sofa. The long legs were utterly ajar. The long arms rested slackly on the sofa's seat. The milky white eyes, set in a dark brown face beneath the brow of a shaved head, stared with utmost sullenness. Roger Two White knew that face immediately because it was even more famous in Atlanta than Coach Buck McNutter's. It was the face of Georgia Tech's All-American football star, a running back named Farik Fannin, constantly referred to in the newspapers and on television as Farik the Cannon Fannin, a local boy, the proudest product of one of Atlanta's most run-down areas, the Bluff, in a neighborhood known as English Avenue. Even slouched back the way he was, with dreadful posture, in this dim room, the young black man radiated physical power. He wore a black polo shirt with red stripes on the collar, wide open at the throat, revealing the long, thick pair of muscles that came down the sides of his neck and inserted at the clavicle.
Adorning his neck was a gold chain so chunky you could have used it to pull an Isuzu pickup out of a red clay ditch. In his forearms and in his elbows and wrists, you could see the dense muscles and cable-like tendons of the real ghetto boy, not to mention a massive gold Rolex watch with diamonds set in the face. And above all, you could see that wary, hostile look through the eyes. The polo shirt hung out over his hips, which were engulfed in a pair of ridiculously voluminous, black, homey jeans that bunched up at his ankles, where they met a pair of black Frankensteins, just like those the college boy had been wearing on Piedmont Avenue. In each of his earlobes, which seemed small for so big a man, was embedded a tiny, diamond-bright gem. They may have been diamonds, and they may have been rhinestones, but Roger Two White wouldn't have put it past a kid like this to insist on diamonds.
"Mr. White," said Buck McNutter, "I want you to meet Farik Fannin."
Farik the Cannon Fannin didn't budge. He waited a couple of beats, then gave Roger Two White a barely perceptible nod and a little shrug of the lips that seemed to say, "So you're here. So what?" McNutter glowered, clenched his teeth, mouthed the words, "Get up," then pantomimed, "Get up," with his chin. The cannon gave McNutter the little lip shrug, which now seemed to say, "Why have I got to put up with this good manners shit?" Slowly, with a great show of world weariness, the cannon got up. Even with his abysmal posture, he towered over Roger Two White. Roger Two White extended his hand, and the cannon deigned to shake it, albeit with a gloriously bored limpness.
"Farik is a member of our football team," said Coach McNutter.
"Oh, I know that very well," said Roger Two White, smiling, looking the young man in the eye, hoping to establish some rapport with this hard case. "I expect everybody in Atlanta knows that. I've been following your adventures along with everybody else." The cannon said nothing. Instead, he gave Roger Two White a quick look up and down, a dubious look, as if to say, "Why would I care what some bitch in a suit like you thinks about me?" There was an awkward silence, and then McNutter said, "Mr. White, I've asked you to come over here tonight because Farik has a problem. I have a problem. Georgia Tech has a problem.
It happened last night at a Freaknik party. Farik's being accused of... He's being accused of rape. Actually, it's a kind of a date rape thing, I suppose you might say. Farik swears he didn't do anything improper, but he's in a real bind. So am I. So is Georgia Tech. The canon looked away and did that little disdainful shrug with his lips again. This time it looked almost like a smirk. McNutter's eyes blazed with reproach. He'd had enough of this ghetto boy cool attitude. All right, Farik. Tell Mr. White who the young woman is. In a bored, barely audible voice, the canon said, "Some white girl goes to Tech." "Some white girl goes to Tech," said McNutter. "Tell Mr. White what some white girl goes to Tech's name is, Farik. Tell him her name." "I know." "In a pig's eye you don't know," roared McNutter. Then he turned to Roger Two White. "I'll tell you who it is, Mr. White. Her name is Elizabeth Armholster. She's Inman Armholster's daughter. That's who she is."
"You're kidding," said Roger Two White, in spite of himself, realizing too late that this was not a very professional response from anyone who fancied himself a high-powered lawyer.
"I'm not kidding," said McNutter. "And he wants Farik's ass, and he wants Georgia Tech's ass. And if we lose Farik, then it's my ass, too."
Inman Armholster. Inman Armholster was one of the first five names you'd think of if the subject was the white establishment in Atlanta. He was in every network worth networking with in this whole town. He was old family and Piedmont driving club all the way. And he was rich as Croesus. He could have been up on that terrace tonight. And even if he wasn't, you could be sure he was invited. Inman Armholster. Roger Two White looked at McNutter, and then he looked at Farik Fannin. Questions came flooding into his mind faster than he could sort them out. But the first one was obvious enough. Why had this big white side of beef, McNutter, called him in? He wasn't a criminal lawyer, and he wasn't a negligence lawyer. He wasn't even a litigator. He was a corporate lawyer, and his specialty was contracts. Inman Armholster wasn't going to be out for money. He was going to be out for blood. Roger Two White looked at the young athlete again, standing there behind his smug shield of coolness, clad in his ridiculous ghetto rags, the little jewelry in his ears and the big jewelry on his neck and wrist catching the light. The football star. Roger Two White had never seen one of these people up close before, but here stood an example of one of the worst role models black youth could emulate. The big-time athlete. The mercenary for hire who assumes that the world owes him money and sex, and lots of both, whenever he wants it, and that he will be immune whatever happens. The code of the mercenary. Rape, pillage, and loot. With no one to answer to. And this sucker has to pick Inman Armholster's daughter. Whether he knew it or not, and he didn't seem to know much, the cannon was now a stick of dynamite. Oh, chocolate Mecca! Chapter 2 The Saddlebags. Almost exactly 36 hours later, which is to say, at 7:30 a.m. Monday, it was one of those brutally bright April mornings you sometimes get in Atlanta. Even up here on the 32nd floor of the Planner's Bank Tower, behind a sealed inch-thick thermoplate glass wall, with a 10-ton HVAC system chundering cold air down from the ceiling, you could sense the heat that would soon oppress the city. The conference room faced east, making the glare from the sun unbearable. There was nothing in front of all that plate glass to reduce it either. No curtains, no blinds, no screens, not one shred, not one slat. Oh, no, the whole thing had been carefully thought out, and everybody at the Planner's Bank end of the table knew exactly what the game was. Everybody, not just the senior loan officer, Raymond Peepgas, knew this breakfast meeting was an elaborate practical joke, starting with the word breakfast. Peepgas had made sure the whole lot of them had been advised that if they wanted breakfast, they had better attend to it before they got here. And that they had done, apparently. Nobody was even looking at the breakfast. They were all settling back and eyeing the mark, the quarry, the prey, or whatever you should call the butt of a practical joke involving $500,000. It was the old man at the other end of the table, the Croker Global Corporation's end. To Peepgas, who was a mere 46, any man 60 years old was an old man, even a man as burly and physically intimidating as Charlie Croker was. Obviously, Croker did not realize he was it. He was reared back confidently in his chair with his suit jacket thrown open. The fool seemed to think he was still one of those real estate developers who own the city of Atlanta. He was grinning at the underlings on either side of him, his lawyers, financial officers, division heads, his aging banking relations preppies, and his so-called executive assistants, who were a couple of real numbers with skirts up to here. Christ, he was a brute, for a man 60 years old. He was an absolute bull. His neck was wider than his head and solid as an oak. Fleetingly, it occurred to Peepgas that he, a member of the first amped-up audio generation, raised in a treeless spec house development outside of San Jose, California, had never, so far as he knew, seen an oak, much less a bull. Croker was almost bald, but his baldness was the kind that proclaims masculinity to burn, as if there was so much testosterone surging up through his hide, it had popped the hair right off the top of his head. Look at him. The way he's beaming at the two numbers with the legs. They're standing, hovering over him. So gorgeous. A pair of real model girls. Miles of blonde hair, both of them, down to their shoulder blades. Long legs, glistening with youth, lubricity, and pantyhose. That one, the taller one, such a lovely long neck, pale skin, a slender face, a full-budding lower lip, a demure high-necked silk blouse with a floppy bow tie of the same wan and vulnerable fabric. Croker looks up at her with a broad grin and says something, and Peepgas can make out only one thing clearly, a name. Peaches. Peaches. He couldn't believe it. Only in Atlanta would you actually come across some blonde bombshell named Peaches. A cloud rose up Peepgas's brainstem. Syria was blonde and sexy too, wasn't she? That little Finnish hooker. A notions buyer for a Helsinki department store. How had he ever let a 105-pound Helsinki notions buyer do what she was now doing to him? With a sinking feeling, more of a nervous intuition than a thought, he realized that the Charlie Crokers of this world would never let any such thing happen to them. Just then Croker's gaze wandered toward a far corner of the room, and a doubtful, puzzled look came over his face. Peepgas's colleague, Harry Zale, the workout artiste, leaned his huge head over and said out of the corner of his mouth, "Hey, Ray, check out the big bobster. He just noticed the dead plant." It was true. Croker's eyes had drifted over to the corner where, in a dismal gloaming, there stood a solitary tropical plant, a dracaena, in a clay pot, dying. Several long, skinny, yellowish fronds drooped over like the tongues of the dead. The pot rested on an otherwise empty expanse of streptolon carpet, pocked with the mashed-in depressions of desk feet, chair casters, and office machines that had been moved somewhere else. The old man had to squint to make it out. He was puzzled. He could hardly see a thing. From where he was sitting, he should have been able to look out through the plate-glass wall and seen much of Midtown Atlanta. The IBM Tower, the GLG Grand, Promenade 1, Promenade 2, the Campanile, the Southern Bell Center, Colony Square, and three of his own buildings, the Phoenix Center, the Moscow Tower, and the Transex Palladium. But he couldn't. It was the glare. He and his contingent had been seated so that they had to look straight into it. Oh, everything about this room was cunningly seedy and unpleasant. The conference table itself was a vast thing, a regular aircraft carrier. But it was put together in modular sections that didn't quite jibe where they met. And its surface was not wood, but some sort of veal-gray plastic laminate. On the table, in front of each of the 24 people present, was a pathetic setting of paperware. A paper cup for the orange juice, a paper mug with fold-out handles for the coffee, which gave off an odor of incinerated PVC cables, and a paper plate with a huge, cold, sticky, cheesy, cowpie-like cinnamon cheddar coffee bun that struck terror into the heart of every man in the room who had ever read an article about arterial plaque or free radicals. That, in its entirety, was the breakfast meeting's breakfast. To top it off, on the walls a pair of no-smoking signs glowered down upon the Croker Global crew with the sort of this-means-you lettering you might expect to find in the cracking unit of an oil refinery, but not at a conference of 24 ladies and gentlemen of banking and commerce in the Planner's Bank Tower in Midtown Atlanta. On second thought, Peep Gas decided, to say that Croker or any other shithead actually noticed all these things at first was probably overstating the case. At first, they merely sensed them, stimulus by stimulus, through their antennae, through the hair on their arms. It was the central nervous system that finally informed the tycoons that they had descended to the status of shithead at Planner's Bank. Shithead was the actual term used at the bank and throughout the industry. Bank officers said shithead in the same matter-of-fact way they said mortgagee, cosigner, or debtor, which was the polite form of shithead, since no borrower was referred to as a debtor until he defaulted. Why did bankers turn so quickly to scatology when loans went bad? Peepgas didn't know. But that was the way they were. At the Harvard Business School back in the 1970s, he had taken a course called Structural Ethics in Corporate Culture, in which the teacher, a Professor Pelfner, had talked about Freud's theory of money and excrement. How did it go? Dr. Freud. He couldn't remember. When people at the bank now referred to Croker as a shithead, they truly meant it. They truly felt it. His botching things was malfeasance. It made them look so goddamned bad. $500 million. Now his heedless, deadbeat squandering was making them all look like fools, suckers, patsies. And he, Raymond Peepgas, was one of the patsies who had signed off on those foolish loans. Fortunately, others up the chain of command had also. Still, he was a senior loan officer, and the banking industry was shrinking, and there were plenty of former senior loan officers of Atlanta banks who were now sitting in their dens in Dunwoody, Decatur, Alpharetta, and Snellville, middle-aged and hopelessly unemployed, staring out the window at their sons' basketball backboards in their driveways. At Planner's Bank today, the watchwords were lean and mean and mental toughness. For 75 years, the bank had been called the Southern Planters Bank and Trust Company. But now that seemed too stodgy, too slow-footed, too old-fashioned, and above all, too Old South. Planters was a word humid with connotations of cotton plantations and slavery. So Planters had been sterilized and pasteurized into Planners. Nobody could object to Planners. Even the most dysfunctional welfare case in the Capitol Homes could be a Planner. Then the two words, Planners and Bank, were fused into Planner's Bank in keeping with the new lean, mean fashion of jamming names together with a capital letter sticking up in the middle. Nation's Bank, Sun Trust, Bell South, Grand Care, Cryolife, Cytritics, Excellinet, 3Com, Microhelp, Home Bank. As if that way you were creating some hyper-hard alloy for the 21st century. The French banque was supposed to show how cosmopolitan, how international, how global, how slick you had become. Obviously, Planner's Bank hadn't exercised sufficient slick, steely mental toughness with Charlie Croker, and Croker's troubles remained a live threat to Peep Gas's position. He was eager to see Harry Zale go to work on that big, arrogant, egomaniacal shithead down there at the end of the table. He leaned over toward Harry and said,
"Well, you about ready?"
"Yep," said Harry.
And then he smiled and winked and said, "Let's take the safeties off the ring binders." Pete Gass's heart jumped inside his ribcage. The male battle was about to begin. But even that much explanation would have been beyond him. He could have used Dr. Freud's help on this one, too. There were a dozen men at the Planner's Bank end of the table. But the show was all Harry Zale's. Harry, who was about 45, had a big, jowly, round head with a thin top dressing of black and gray hair combed straight back and a chin that swelled out like a melon. He was one of those mesomorphs who have short arms and thick chests and torsos. Just now Harry was jotting down a note, and you couldn't help but be aware that he was left-handed, because he was the type of awkward left-hander who hunches way over and curls his shoulder, arm, wrist, and hand into a pretzel shape as he writes. But for what he did, Harry Zale looked perfect. He was a workout artiste, and the workout artistes were the Marines, the Commandos, the G.I. Joes of commercial banking. Or maybe the term should be D.I. for drill instructor, since Harry liked to refer to what was about to take place not as a workout session, but as boot camp. The time had come, and so Pete Gass drew himself up in his seat and raised his voice and announced to the entire table, "All right, ladies and gentlemen," and then he paused. What he meant to say next was a brusque, "Time to get started." But that was close to being an order, and he was not sure he could look Charlie Croker in the face and bark out an order. And so he said, "Why don't we get started?" The Croker Global people who had been standing now took their seats. The fabulous bird, Peaches, sat right next to Croker. The other sat several seats away. Peep Gas had no intention of referring to Croker by name. Or if he had to, he wouldn't call him Charlie. He'd call him Mr. Croker as coldly as he could, by way of letting him know that things have changed, that he was no longer a star customer, a priceless pal, and an Atlanta business giant. He was just another shithead. But as he looked at Croker's square-jawed face and massive neck, the memory of how fawningly, how ingratiatingly, how constantly he had called him Charlie, of how many times he had charlied him within an inch of his life, came flashing back to him. And, contrary to every conscious intention, he heard himself saying, "Charlie, I believe you met Harry on the way in." He gestured toward the workout artiste. "Harry's the head of our real estate asset management department. Eventually, although not immediately, the shitheads always figured out the acronym. And so I've asked Harry..." He paused again. He couldn't think of how to say what it was Harry was about to do. "I've asked Harry to get things underway." Harry didn't even look up. He just kept on writing on a yellow legal pad with his left arm and hand all curled around it. Silence commandeered the room. It was as if Harry had more important things than Mr. Charles E., for Earl, Croker, on his mind. Presently he lifted his big chin. He sighted Croker down his nose and let his gaze linger, and linger, and linger, without saying a word, the way a father might lead into a man-to-man talk with a boy who knows he's been bad. And then he said, in a high-pitched, rasping voice, "Why are we here, Mr. Croker? Why are we having this meeting? What's the problem?" Oh, Peepgas loved this part of Harry's workout sessions, the rude, grating, condescending way they started off. This was why a workout artiste like Harry Zale was known as an artiste. This was artistry. This was boot camp in the Planner's Bank Tower. Croker stared at the artiste. Then he turned and looked past Peaches toward his chief financial officer, a young but dour presence named Wismer Strook, probably not much more than 30, who wore glasses with rectangular titanium frames and had pale skin, a heavy 5 o'clock shadow, and the sunken cheeks and stringy neck peculiar to compulsive joggers. Croker smiled at Strook in a smirking way, and this smile said, "Hey, what kind of cute little stunt is this supposed to be? Who is this character? What is this 'why are we here' bullshit?" Harry kept staring at Croker, never once blinking. But Peepgas had to give Croker credit. He didn't blink either. How long would it take Harry to get the saddlebags this time? Everybody rated Harry's performance that way, according to how long it took him to get the saddlebags. Finally, Croker said, "You call this meeting, my friend?" "My friend." He spoke with a South Georgia drawl. Croker had lived in Atlanta for 40 years, but his act, Peepgas regarded it as an act, was Baker County. Peepgas had never set foot in the place, of course, but he took Baker County to be about as redneck as it got in Georgia. It was in Baker County that one of the first big civil rights protests of the 1960s had been ignited. A sheriff known as Gator Johnson had shot a black man named Ware after Ware had made a pass at the black mistress of the white overseer of a plantation belonging to Robert Woodruff, the president of Coca-Cola. "Gator Johnson," thought Peepgas. And if you read all the articles about Charlie Croker in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Atlanta Magazine, and the profiles that had run in Forbes and the Wall Street Journal, you had to endure constant references to the piney woods, the swamps, hunting, fishing, horses, snakes, raccoons, wild boars, infantry combat, football, and a lot of other Southern manhood stuff. But above all, football. Back in the late 1950s, when Georgia Tech was a national football power, Charlie Croker had been not only a star running back, but a linebacker, one of the last players on any major football team to play both offense and defense, earning him the title, on the Atlanta sports pages, of the 60-minute man. The 60-minute man became a local legend his senior year in the closing seconds of the big game with Tech's arch-rival, the University of Georgia. With 45 seconds left on the clock, Tech was losing 20-7, when Croker ran 42 yards for a touchdown. The score was now 20-14. Following the kickoff, with 21 seconds remaining, Georgia was trying to eat up the clock with routine running plays when the Georgia quarterback attempted yet another handoff to his fullback. And Croker blitzed through the line from his linebacker position and took the ball out of the quarterback's hand before his own fullback could reach it, knocked the fullback to the ground like a bowling pin, and ran 40 yards for another touchdown. And Tech won 21-20. To this day, old-timers recognized him in malls or lobbies and yelled out, "The 60-minute man!" Atlanta Magazine had asked him what kind of exercise regimen he followed now, almost 50 years later. And Peepgas had always remembered Croker's answer.
"Exercise regimen? Who the hell's got time for an exercise regimen? On the other hand, when I need firewood, I start with a tree."
Croker was the kind who liked to be known as Charlie, not Charles, because it was earthier. On his own plantation in Baker County, he actually had his black employees call him Captain Charlie, or just Cap'n. But he was the kind of Cap'n Charlie who always had to let you know he was a self-made Cap'n Charlie.
"And since it's your meetin'," the captain continued, "I spec you're gettin' ready to tell us why."
He said it with such a relaxed smile, Peepgas began to wonder if Harry was going to get any saddlebags at all.
"No, I want to know if you know," said Harry. "Think of this as an AA meeting, Mr. Croker. Now that the spree is over, we want to see some real self-awareness here."
"You're right, we called this meeting, but I want you to tell me why. What's it all about? What's the problem here?"
Peepgas watched Croker's face. Oh, he loved this part, too, the moment when the shitheads finally realized that things have changed, that their status has taken a header into the excrement. Croker eyed Harry, really sizing him up now, not sure how to play it. They never were. Every manly fiber in his being, and Charlie Croker's being was positively thick with manly fiber, wanted to put this condescending asshole in his place, firmly and rapidly. But if the session turned into a personal pissing match, he was at a distinct disadvantage. The condescending asshole could cause him severe grief. Planners Bank held all the cards. Planners Bank could bring six other banks and two insurance companies piling in on top of him. Croker Global owed the other lenders an additional $285 million, making a total of $800 million, of which $160 million were notes he, Croker, was personally liable for.
"Well, we're here," said Croker at last. "We're here, and if you don't know why you're here, then we can't help you out, to see about restructuring this thing. And we've come here with a good, solid business plan, and I think you're going to love it."
With that, he reared back in his chair again, mighty pleased with himself, and Wismer Strook and the rest of the financial types and lawyers and division heads and the banking relations preppies and Peaches and the other model girl reared back also, looking mighty pleased with himself, too.
"But what is this thing?" asked the artiste. "You're talking about solutions, about a way out. First, we gotta know what we're in, because it's getting deep, and it's thick, and it's slimy. The Croker Global Corporation is sinking into the ooze. You're disappearing on us, Mr. Croker, like the lost continent. Before we lose you, you gotta tell me what this ooze is."
At this point, Croker did something Peepgas had never seen a shithead do before. Quite nonchalantly, he stood up, looking neither this way nor that,
as if there was no one else in the room. He was a mountain. He took off his jacket, and as he did so, his chest flexed into a couple of massive hillocks. He undid his cufflinks and rolled up his sleeves, and his forearms looked like a pair of country hams.
Peepgas had seen pictures of country hams in the Christmas mail-order catalogs that every credit card holder in metropolitan Atlanta received.
He loosened his necktie and unbuttoned his shirt at the collar, and his mighty neck swelled out until it seemed to merge with his trapezii in one continuous slope to the shoulders. And then he arched his back and stretched and preened and showed the room his omnipotent deltoids and latissimi dorsi, which bulged beneath his shirt. Then he sat down again. His minions, Peaches and the rest, rose in their seats and then settled back with him.
"Now," said Charlie Croker, narrowing his eyes, lifting his chin, and putting on the grimace that signifies tolerance stretched just about to its limits. "You said something about ooze? Something about ooze?"
Peepgas's heart tripped faster still. The male battle was now surely joined. Harry was a bulldog. He wouldn't let go, and he wouldn't let the big boffster break up his routine.
"That's right, Mr. Croker. Ooze."
Harry threw in a lot of Mr. Croker's, but Croker wouldn't lower himself to utter Harry's name, if indeed he knew it.
"Ooze, as in Ooze Creek. It seems to me we're drifting up Ooze Creek without a paddle."
Now began a round of verbal fencing in which the artiste kept cutting off Croker's evasions, blusters, rambles, tangents, until finally Croker was in a corner where there was nothing to do but come forth with the damning information. Even so, he sidestepped at the last moment and made his grim young sidekick, Wismer Strook, say the actual words. Strook was very nearly Croker's opposite. Croker was all heartiness and manly charm and bluster and down-home drawl and cagey old dog of the South. Strook was all MBA youth and low cholesterol and high-density lipids and semiconductor circuits, and by his voice you couldn't tell where he was from, unless it was the Wharton School of Business and Economics. Yes, he said, Croker Global had borrowed a total of $515 million from Planners Bank, and yes, Croker Global had now failed to come up with $36 million in scheduled interest payments and a scheduled $60 million repayment of principal.
"But this situation is not acute," said Wismer Strook.
Peepgas cut a glance at Harry, and they both smiled. The developers and their minions never used the word problem. To these shitheads, there were only situations.
"The underlying assets remain sound," Strook continued. "After the market saturation of 1989 and 1990, the absorption rate of commercial space in Metro Atlanta has steadily increased, and vacancies have dropped below 20%. Making Croker Concourse, as a prime outer perimeter property, perfectly positioned for the inevitable upswing in demand. As for Croker Global Foods, our facilities are mainstays in 14 key markets, from Contra Costa County, California, to Monmouth County, New Jersey. It just so happens that all our divisions have been hit simultaneously by the same cyclical downturn, that's all. What we are talking about here is a cash flow situation. All our divisions have potential for tremendous growth in the near term once the general climate improves. Now, you take Global Foods."
Oh, he was very smooth in his modem-mouth fashion, this Wismer Strook. He commenced a disquisition about Croker Global Foods and its wholesale food distribution centers, and about emerging pockets of regional restaurant strength, and food deflation, and dampened margins, and the enhanced pricing of crop packs.
Harry let Strook have his head until he said, "Anyway, what we're really looking at here is the prospect of a significant uptick in cash flow over the next 2 quarters. This is not a stagnant situation by any means. All we really need is a temporary freeze on these big principal payments and—"
"Whoa!" said Harry with a grating whine. "Whoa, whoa, whoa! Did I hear the word freeze?"
Then he looked at Charlie Croker.
"Mr. Croker, did Mr. Strook just say something about freezing the principal payments?"
He kept staring at Croker with his chin lifted and his head cocked, as if his credulity was being put to a severe test.
"Let me tell you two gentlemen something about loans. A loan is not a gift. When we make a loan, we actually expect to get paid back."
"Nobody's talking about not paying you back," snapped Croker. "We're talking about something very simple. Something very simple."
"Simple, I like," said the artiste. "I'd like to hear some simple proposals as to how we're going to get paid back. Simple. No assembly necessary, batteries included."
Peepgas noticed that the first little dark crescents of sweat were beginning to form on Croker's shirt beneath his arms.
"That happens to be precisely what we've been showing you," he said.
"All I've heard so far are some projections concerning office leasing in Atlanta and the American food service industry," said the artiste. "We're talking about $500 million here."
"Look," said Charlie Croker, "you may recall that one of your own people, Mr. John Sycamore, assured us over and over again that if—"
"Mr. Sycamore is no longer on the case."
"Well, that may be, but Mr. Sycamore is no longer a factor here."
"Yeah, but the fact is, he was your representative, and he practically got down on his knees, and Mr. Sycamore's hopes begged us to take that last $180 million loan and assured us, Mr. Sycamore's hopes, if any situation arose regarding the payback schedule, he, Mr. Sycamore's hopes and dreams, whatever they were, no longer exist, so far as the obscene mess we have now is concerned. They disappeared down the memory hole."
Charlie Croker stared, steaming. Peepgas smiled to himself, albeit morosely. If John Sycamore had any sense, he was, at this moment, busy sending out resumes. A dapper and ebullient little fellow, Sycamore had been the salesman, the line officer, who had opened the door to Charlie Croker and Croker Global's $500 million worth of debt. At the time, that had made Sycamore a star, a real first-tier operator, to use the Planner's Bank parlance. Back then, big loans were spoken of as sales, and hotshots like Sycamore worked for the marketing department. Now that the huge debt had gone bad, Sycamore's career at Planner's Bank was a shambles. He was officially a shithead, too. Seeing that Croker was once again speechless, Harry chose this moment to take off his jacket. He stood up and removed it very slowly. Peepgas knew what was coming. This was always a great touch. In the process of taking his jacket off, the artiste thrust his thick chest forward. Running down it were a pair of suspenders. They were broad and black, these suspenders, and even at the other end of the table you couldn't miss the motif embroidered on them in dead white, the skull and crossbones, repeated over and over. As for Charlie Croker, the shitheads Peepgas had observed always pretended they hadn't noticed the damnable death's head suspenders, although later, if they were in any mood to reminisce, they would invariably ask about the suspenders and inquire if this had been a calculated gesture on the artiste's part, or if he just happened to be wearing a pair of skull and crossbone suspenders. Croker did the usual. He tried to act as if he hadn't noticed. He looked away and scanned the room. But of course there was no relief there, just more of the cheap and seedy details, the streptolon carpet,
the synthetic furniture, the no-smoking signs, the glare, the dying Dracaena, the vile cinnamon cheddar coffee buns on the paper plates. The little crescents of sweat under the tycoon's arms, Peep Gas now noticed, had become full half-moons. An elaborate practical joke. Yet none of it was designed simply to humiliate the shitheads and punish them for their sins. What would be the point of that? When you needed them to help you recover hundreds of millions of dollars? No, this was boot camp, in Harry Zale's formulation. The main purpose of a boot camp, like the Marine boot camp at Paris Island — Harry had been in the Marines during the war in Vietnam — the main purpose of a boot camp was psychological conditioning. The idea was to strip away the recruit's old habits, soft comforts, and home-turf ties, and turn him into a new man, a U.S. Marine. Well, your typical shithead was a business executive who arrived at a workout session with bad habits, creature comforts, regal ties, a layer of fat, and an ego that would have made the Sun King flinch. The word tycoon, from the Japanese meaning mighty ruler, might be a cliché, but it was no exaggeration in the case of your typical chief executive officer of an American corporation here at the turn of the century. He was surrounded by people who jumped whenever he crooked a finger or cut a glance. They performed all onerous chores for him, no matter how slight. Your typical big shithead like Charlie Croker had not had to stand in line at an airport, walk through a metal detector, or utter his name to someone at a counter for years, unless it was to board the Concorde. He lived a life of private planes, private elevators, hotel suites, Lucullan meals, golf weekends, ski weekends, ranch weekends, and cutie pie weekends, as in boffing bimbos in the Caribbean, which was one of Harry's favorite phrases. A big boffster like Charlie Croker was an executive who used the company airline to go boffing bimbos in the Caribbean and kept the executive offices positively awiggle with cutie pies, such as the pair who were seated with him at this very table right now. To see this shithead go on in these magazine articles about what a son of the down-home sod he was ludicrous. At the outset, Peep Gas had to admit, Planner's Bank had only made things worse. In the quest for big sales, line officers like John Sycamore had catered to the tycoon's every lordly vice. The bank had treated Croker to enough food at the Planner's Club, up on the 50th floor of the Planner's Bank Tower, and at the dining room of the Ritz-Carlton Buckhead, to keep half of Ethiopia alive for a year. And Cap'n Charlie, no dummy, had buttered up his lenders as well. A real first-tier officer was one who maintained a close personal tie with the big borrower. So, when Charlie Croker had telephoned Sycamore to say he had an extra ticket to the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Sycamore had risen from his dying mother's bedside at Piedmont General Hospital and left her a number at the clubhouse where she could reach him if she felt she was departing this trough of mortal error for good. In those, the palmy days, when Croker visited Planner's Bank, he was taken straight to the executive floor, the 49th, where there was a reception room with a $270,000 custom-made rug the size of a tennis court. And he had sat only at conference tables of mahogany with fruitwood bandings, amid walnut-paneled walls and more custom carpeting, and was served only viands by the in-house chef and coffee from New Orleans in bone chinaware bearing Planner's Bank's logo, a highly stylized creative director's phoenix with outstretched wings, beneath white ceilings fitted with pinhole spotlights that lit up pictures so baffling they were bound to be worth a fortune. And beyond the glass window walls, always exquisitely curtained against glare, all of Atlanta, with its new glass towers rising up like the Emerald City of Oz, was laid out before him. "It's all yours, Charlie."
There was one more thing about the shithead's relationship with the bank, something Peepgas never talked about to anybody at the bank, even though he was sure that plenty of his colleagues were aware of it and felt it. There were believed to be, he knew very well what people outside banking thought, had known it ever since his days at the Harvard Business School, there were believed to be two kinds of males in American business. There were the true male animals, who went into investment banking, hedge funds, arbitrage, real estate development, and other forms of empire building. They were the gamblers, plungers, traders, risk-takers. In short, the Charlie Croakers of this world. And then there were the passive males, who went into commercial banking, where all you did was lend money and sit back and collect interest. At Harvard, the only thing considered duller, safer, and less adventurous than working for a bank was working for some old-line, can't-miss industrial firm like Otis Elevator, which only needed caretakers. The Charlie Croakers were convinced that if they got in a tight corner, they could always manipulate the banking types, such as Raymond Peepgas. Using their stronger wills, greater guile, and higher levels of testosterone, they could always get them to roll over their out-of-control loans, restructure them, refinance them, or otherwise push trouble off into an open-ended future. But lo, somewhere in the shallows of the Planner's Bank hormone pool, the bank had found the likes of Harry Zale, the workout artiste, the bank's own marine drill instructor. Harry was here to make the shitheads pop too, to render the fat, melt down the ego, separate the soul from its vain props, and create a new man, a shithead who actually focuses on paying back the money. Still standing, Harry took a deep breath, which thrust his chest out and flaunted the skull and crossbone suspenders even more flagrantly. Then he sat down and raised his big chin and looked down his nose once more, and gave Charlie Croaker another lingering stare, and said, "Okay, Mr. Croaker, we're all waiting. The floor is now open for concrete proposals for paying back money. As I said, simple we like, no assembly necessary, batteries included." It was probably the artiste's infatuation with this little metaphor of his that finally did it. Croaker had been no assembly necessaried, batteries included, wire we heared, dead racined, coffee burned, lectured at, and trifled with long enough. He leaned forward with his huge forearms on the table and the testosterone flowing. His shoulders and neck seemed to swell up. He thrust his own square jaw forward, and the lawyers and the accountants all hunched forward with him. And so did Peaches. A small and ominous smile was now on Croaker's face. His voice was low, controlled, and seething.
"Well, now, friend, I want to ask you something. You ever been hunting?"
Harry said nothing. He just put on a smile exactly like Croaker's.
"You ever headed out in a pickup truck early in the morning and listened to all those old boys talking about all the buds they're going to shoot? People, they shoot a lot of buds with their mouths on the way out to the fields. With their mouths. But comes a time when you finally got to stop the truck and pick up a gun and do something with it. See? Down where I grew up in Baker County, there's a saying, when the tailgate drops, the bullshit stops."
He eyed Harry even more intently. Harry just stared back without blinking, without altering his little smile so much as an eighth of an inch.
"And there's been a certain amount of bullshit in this room this morning," Croaker continued, "if you don't mind the introduction of some plain English into these proceedings. Well, now the tailgate's dropped. We're here with a serious business plan and a serious proposal for restructuring these loans and straightening out this situation. But we're not here for a lecture about the nature of loan obligations. See? I'm not sure who the hell you think you're talking to, but I know exactly you need to be straightened out. I know exactly on a couple of things my I know exactly, friend, because I know exactly who I'm talking to, Mr. Croker."
Croker's voice was low and strong, but Harry's high, grinding whine cut through it.
"I'm talking to an individual who owes this bank $500 million and 6 other banks and 2 insurance companies $285 million more. That's who I'm talking to. And you know there's an old saying here in Atlanta, too, and that saying is money talks and bullshit walks, and the time has come to talk with money, Mr. Croker. All I'm telling you is what's already obvious. All I'm telling you are some home truths in the privacy of this room. You want to throw this thing open to all 7 banks and the 2 insurance companies and have a real workout session? We can do that. Happens all the time. It'll have to be in an auditorium. 9 different lenders? We're talking about more than 100 people sitting in an auditorium with an audio system and microphones, and it'll be incumbent upon every one of those lenders to pick up a microphone and tell you something over the wall speakers that I'm going to tell you right now, very quietly, in this little room, across this table, on behalf of only one lender, Planners Bank, and it's this, Mr. Croker." Seeing that Croker was suitably stunned by his belligerence, the artiste paused for maximum effect and then said in a menacingly calm voice, "This is one of the worst cases of corporate mismanagement, one of the grossest violations of a fiduciary obligation I've ever seen. And in my job I look down the gullet of mismanagement and malfeasance every day. You and your corporation have taken $500 million from this bank, Mr. Croker, and treated it like your own private freaknik, like you could take $500 million from us and do anything you wanted with it. Go hog wild, go freaknik, because nobody could touch you, because this was freaknik time for Croker Global and the town was yours. Well, I got news for you, Mr. Croker. This ain't Saturday night no more. Freaknik's over, baby. You know what I'm saying?" Pete Gass's heart was pounding. He couldn't tell whether Harry was imitating Croker's down-home accent or a black accent or both. "This here's the morning after, bro, and Croker Global's got the biggest hangover in the history of debt defalcation in the southeastern United States." Now Pete Gass's eyes were fastened on Charlie Croker. Croker looked as if his breath had been knocked out. He no longer looked furious. The smoke was no longer coming out of his ears. He still stared at Harry, but his stare was frozen and opaque. The artiste, oh yes, this was artistry. It wasn't that the artiste was tougher than the tycoon, more of a man, and had dominated him in a fair fight. No, it was the tone, the stance the artiste dared assume, the insolence he so cavalierly brandished as his natural prerogative, the way he lifted his big chin and looked down his nose and, with every twist of his body and his grating whine, announced, "Behold, nothing but another shithead!" With a few arcs of that chin, he had knocked the vein props out from under the great man, ripped away the insulation and the princely protocol, and left him sitting, white and plump, in his birthday suit. A sinner, a debtor, a deadbeat minus his dignity, naked before an unsparing dun. Pete Gass noticed the tycoon's half-moons had begun to enlarge, and had spread across his shirt along the curves on the underside of his mighty chest muscles. Harry began speaking in a softer, lower voice. "Listen, Mr. Croker, don't get me wrong. We're on your side here. We don't want this to turn into a free-for-all with 9 lenders either. And we wouldn't particularly look forward to the press coverage." He paused to let that terrorist threat, the press, stalk the room. "We're the agent bank in this setup, and that gives us the privilege of looking out for Planners Bank first of all. But we got to come up with something concrete." He extended his right fist up in the air as high as it would go and said, "Where's the money going to come from? It ain't going to come poof." He sprung his fist open. "From out of the air. Mr. Strook assures us you got a lot of sound assets. Okay, good. The time has come to make them liquid.
The time has come to pay us back. The time has come to sell something. I'm with you. The tailgate has dropped.
At that point, young Strook jumped in, evidently to give his boss, Croker, time to get his breath back and his battered wits together. Just selling something, said Strook, was not such an easy proposition. Croker Global had considered this particular option. But in the first place, there was a complex of interlocking ownerships. Certain corporate structures within Croker Global's real estate portfolio actually owned certain independently structured divisions of Croker Global Foods, each of which was a corporation in its own right, and...
I'm aware of all that, said the artiste. I've got your organization chart. I'm entering it in the Orgoff.
The Orgoff, said Wismar Strook.
Yeah, that's a contest we have at Planner's Bank for the worst-looking organization chart. I thought nobody was going to be able to beat Chai Long Shipping out of Hong Kong. They got 300 ships, and each ship is a separate corporation, and each corporation owns a fraction of at least 5 other ships, and each ship has a color code, and the chart is 10 feet long. Looks like a Game Boy semiconductor panel blown up. I thought Chai Long was a sure thing in the Orgoff until I saw yours. Yours looks like a bowl of linguine primavera. You just gotta untangle it and sell something.
Uh-huh. I see. Do you mind if I finish?
No, I don't mind, but why don't we entertain a few modest proposals first?
The artiste turned to an assistant on his other side and said in a low voice, "Give me the cars, Sheldon." The young man, Sheldon, snapped open a ring binder and handed Harry a sheet of paper. The artiste studied it for a moment, then looked up at Croker and said,
"Now, in your last financial statement, you list 7 company automobiles, 3 BMW 750Ls, valued at, what's it say here, $93,000 each, 2 BMW 540As, valued at $55,000 each, a Ferrari 355, valued at $129,000, and a customized Cadillac Seville STS valued at $75,000. By the way, how'd you get here this morning?"
Croker gave the artiste a long death-ray stare, then said, "I drove."
"What'd you drive? A BMW? The Ferrari? The customized Cadillac Seville STS? Which one?"
Croker eyed him balefully, but said nothing. The steam was coming back into his system. His mighty chest rose and fell with a prodigious sigh. The dark stains were inching closer, from either side of his chest, toward the sternum. Harry said,
"7 company cars. Sell 'em."
"Those cars are in constant use," said Croker. "Besides, suppose we sold 'em, to the distinct disadvantage of our operations, by the way. What are we talking about here, $200,000?
"Hey," said the artiste with a big smile, "I don't know about you, but I have great respect for $200,000. Besides, your arithmetic's a little off. It's $593,000. A 1,000 more insignificant items like that, and we've got $500 million and plenty to spare. See how easy it is? Sell 'em."
He turned to his assistant again and said, "Give me the airplanes." The ring binder snapped open, and the assistant, Sheldon, gave him several sheets of paper.
"Now, Mr. Croker," said Harry, looking at the pages, "you also list 4 aircraft, 2 Beach Jet 400As, a Super King Air 350, and a Gulfstream 5.
Then he looked up at Croker, and in a voice like W.C. Fields's, repeated,
"A Gulfstream 5, a G-5. That's a $38 million aircraft, if I'm not mistaken, and I see here that yours has certain enhancements. A SATCOM telephone system, $300,000 installed. A SATCOM telephone enabled you to telephone while you're aloft from anywhere in the world, isn't that correct?"
"Yeah," said Croker.
"How many of Croker Global's operations are overseas, Mr. Croker?"
As of now, none, but... And I see you've also got a set of Skywatch cabin radar display screens worth $125,000 installed, and a cabin interior custom designed and furnished by a Mr. Ronald Vine for $2,845,000. And it says here there's a painting installed on that airplane worth $190,000.
The artiste raised his great chin and looked down his nose at Croker with a mixture of incredulity and disdain.
Are those figures correct?
They come straight from your financial statement. You presented these items as collateral.
That's right.
That's $40 million tied up in that one aircraft.
He turned to his assistant.
What's the total value of the other three planes, Sheldon?
$15,900,000.
$15,900,000, said Harry. So now we're talking about $58 million worth of airplanes. Where do you keep those airplanes, Mr. Croker?
Out at PDK, said Croker, referring to the airport for private aircraft in DeKalb County, just east of the city. PDK was short for Peachtree DeKalb.
You lease hangar space there?
Yeah.
How many pilots do you employ?
12.
12?
The artiste arched his eyebrows and whistled through his teeth in mock surprise. He smiled.
We're going to save you a whole lot of money.
He smiled again, as if this was all great fun. Then the smile vanished, and he said with a toneless finality, "Sell 'em."
"That we could always do," said Croker, "but it would be totally self-defeating. Those aircraft are not used in a frivolous manner. In Global Foods we got 17 warehouses in 14 states. We got, sell 'em. We got, sell 'em. From now on we're going to be like the Viet Cong. We're going to travel on the ground and live off the land."
He now turned to Sheldon and said something out of the side of his mouth that Peep Gas didn't catch. The young man's binder popped open, and he handed the artiste 3 or 4 sheets of paper. Harry studied them for a moment and then said, without looking up,
"The experimental farm."
He sounded like W.C. Fields again.
29,000 acres in Baker County, Georgia. We got the correct spelling here, T-U-R-P-M-T-I-N-E?
That's right, said Croker.
The place is called Turpentine?
Turpentine, Croker said with an edge to his voice. It's always been called that. Turpentine's been in operation since the 1830s. For the first 50 or 60 years, the only crop they had there was turpentine, and that was the way the farm workers pronounced it, turpentine. As a matter of fact, they called themselves the Turpentine people. That was all they did for generations. They harvested turpentine from the pine trees. We got descendants of these people working there right now. Peep Gas wondered why Croker was suddenly so forthcoming, informative, and reflective.
It's listed here, said Harry, as an experimental farm. My information is that it's a plantation.
Well, down there below the gnat line, said Croker in an amiable voice, anything much over 500 acres, they're liable to call it a plantation.
Yeah, said Harry, but my impression is that Turpentine is known specifically as a quail plantation. Do you shoot quail at Turpentine?
It's quail country. Certainly we shoot some quail there. Be hard to resist.
But would you say that's the main enterprise at Turpentine? Shooting quail? Mr. Sycamore visited Turpentine several times, I believe, and that was his impression.
Croker's huge chest delivered another labored sigh. Peepgas knew exactly what he was thinking. First they tell me Sycamore's out of the picture, and now they're quoting him as an authority. But what he said was,
Turpentine's been a working farm for more than a century and a half, and it's still a working farm. In fact, now more than it's ever been. It's a main testing ground for our food division.
He was now dropping G's by the bushel.
We got more'n 1,000 experimental plats at Turpentine where we're running experiments on crop production and rotation and tilling. We got experiments with robots that'll level an acre of... And you also got 59 horses, valued at $4,700,000, according to this, said the artiste. He held up one of the sheets of paper Sheldon had handed him. What do these 59 horses do? They don't pull plows, do they?
The horses are a profitable business in their own right, said Croker, managing to control his temper. The market for good horses is fireproof. Besides that, we got a good stud business.
That's what I understand, said the artiste, studying a sheet of paper. It says here you got a stud named First Draw, and he's worth $3 million.
He lifted his big chin and peered down his nose at Croker.
That's true, said Croker.
Harry said,
First Draw, does that horse's name by any chance allude in some way to the proceeds of a real estate construction loan?
Sniggers and guffaws from the Planner's Bank end of the table, and not even Croker's somber young Wismer Strook could resist a small smile. Croker paused, then said with a sudden burst of joviality,
"It's a gambling term. Refers to the game of draw poker.